This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producer for the program, Harriet Williamson. Jason Croft is at the controls for this hour, and Kyle Mabry was on for hour number one. In December, the man known to North Koreans as the Dear Leader, Kim Jong-il, died of a heart attack. Power has passed to his third son, Kim Jong-un. But so little is known about him that even his precise age remains something of a mystery. This morning in this hour of Focus, we'll be talking with Bruce Cummings. He is professor of history at the University of Chicago and, among other things, is an authority on modern Korean history. We'll be talking about what the recent change in leadership might mean for North Korea, for its relations with the South and with the rest of the world. And, of course, questions from people who are listening are welcome. We ask is people just try to keep their questions brief. That way we can keep moving along. But questions are welcome. You have couple of ways to join the conversation. You can call here in Champaign-Urbana. The number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, so if it's a long-distance call, use that one. And that's 800-222-9455. And you can also send us an email, and the address is will-talk@illinois.edu. And at any point, if you'd like to join in, you are certainly welcome to do that. And Professor Cummings, hello.
How are you?
I'm good, thanks. And thank you very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate you giving us some of your time. Kim Jong-il died on the 17th of December, and his death was announced 2 days later. It was certainly known that he had been in poor health. He'd had a stroke in 2008, and I think pretty much it was assumed that the heir apparent was his son, Kim Jong-un. We've known that for more than a year. It still seemed, though, that when the elder Kim died, it rather caught the world off guard. Was it really such a surprise?
Well, I think it was very predictable that Kim Jong-il would pass on leadership to one of his sons. He had three sons, and for a long time, the older one, Kim Jong-nam, was thought to be the heir apparent. Eldest sons have more privilege than the others in Korean culture. For various reasons, he, I think, didn't have the kind of dignity that the leadership there expected from him, and also seems to prefer living in Macau, where he's supposed to enjoy gambling. So he's out. The middle son, really even less is known about him. I'm aware of only one photo of him. Kim Jong-un is the youngest son. He's somewhere between 28 and 30. No one's quite sure. But the North Koreans did they did cite his birthday on January 8th yesterday. So at least we know that. I think that it was very predictable that one of the sons would become the leader. I think what is surprising is that it happened before even the leadership itself would have expected. Kim Jong-il's stroke was serious, but it wasn't incapacitating, and he recovered over a period of months in 2008, and recently looked rather vigorous in meetings with the Chinese last May and in so-called on-the-spot guidance, which he was actually doing when he died. So I think everybody was taken by surprise by that. But in this country in particular, North Korea is seen as not only a dangerous and repressive dictatorship, but very unpredictable. But on my first visit to North Korea in 1981, I came in on a Chinese aircraft and wanted to go out on the Trans-Siberian Railway, and I was told to go to the Soviet embassy to get a visa. So I went there, and a very nice fellow, one of their Korea experts, sat me down, asked me what I was doing there, gave me some cognac, and we were talking. And in the course of it, he asked me what I thought about Kim Jong-il, who had been named his father's successor at the 6th Party Congress a year before. And I said something like, well, you know, he looks a lot like his mother, not his father. He's rather diminutive. He's pear-shaped. His mother was about 4'10". He's about 5'2", and not handsome like his father. And this Soviet diplomat said, oh, you Americans, always talking about personality, you should come back here in the year 2020 and watch his son take power. In other words, the grandson of Kim Il-sung. Mm-hmm. So it happened 8 years before that prediction, but it's one of the best predictions about North Korea that I've ever heard.
Mm. Well, what strikes me as interesting when you tell that story is that so many people say that they think that Kim Jong-un takes after his grandfather, and that perhaps that somehow his resemblance to Kim Il-sung is very salient here.
It is very salient. Kim Jong-nam, the older son, is not a handsome person. He has a rather full beard, which he doesn't shave all the time. And there are many pictures of him looking both a little bit obese and tacky or unshaven. Kim Jong-un not only looks like his grandfather, but they've shaved his head up an inch or so to make him look just like Kim Il-sung did in the late 1940s. I have photos of Kim Il-sung from that period, and he's just a spitting image of his grandfather. And this is more important than simply a resemblance, although the North Koreans do pay a great deal of attention to bloodlines, as their forebears did in the pre-modern period. Kim Il-sung also was a person who went out and pressed the flesh a lot. He was always smiling. He was very happy, appearing at least, always smiling. Kim Jong-il just couldn't do that. He always looked dour and rather cynical. The son was just shown yesterday on a tape doing the same thing his grandfather did. Mm-hmm. So that is, something that's important. But more than that, I really think North Korea is the most fascinating and in some ways astonishing recapture of a communist state by traditional political culture that the world has ever seen. And in some ways, it accounts for why North Korea still exists more than 20 years after the Berlin Wall fell. In other words, North Koreans have known only monarchy for millennia or dictatorships for the last 100 years, beginning with the Japanese colonial dictatorship, in which emperor worship was forced on the Korean people. Kingly worship and endless songs, poems, stories about how great the king was, how he could walk on water, all this stuff, was just transferred whole cloth to Kim Il-sung. And it leads to absurdities, particularly in the modern era. Kim Jong-il playing his first golf game and scoring a bunch of eagles and all this stuff. Hmm. North Koreans compete with each other to flatter and prove their loyalty to the leader. But in Korean political culture, this is much less abhorrent, or I should say much less surprising, than it would be to Americans who got rid of monarchy 200 years ago.
One of the things that and you told the story about how Kim Jong-il was very sober and seeming in public not particularly comfortable, and that now just recently we've had some of these images of his son smiling, laughing, being more social, shaking hands with people in some of the recent things that we have seen. And I think that some people have looked at that and looked at how things have gone, at least so far, in the transition from father to son, and said that it's striking how that in the case of Kim Jong-il, that it took him a lot longer to settle in to that role. And that it's something that in the case of Kim Jong-un, I don't know whether it just comes easier to him or what it is, but that he seems to be making that transition much more quickly and maybe more easily than his father did.
Well, they're certainly making haste in giving him a whole bunch of not really titles, but rubrics, the great successor, supreme leader of the military and all of that. He actually has only one formal title, which is Secretary of the Central Committee of the Workers' Party, which is their Communist Party. I would attribute this in part to the surprise that happened. I don't think anyone thought Kim Jong-il was going to die of a heart attack. They thought he might die of a second stroke. But Kim Jong-il himself had far more preparation than Kim Jong-un. Kim Jong-un has essentially been prepared, and everybody in North Korea has known this, for about 3 years, going back to August of 2008, when his father had a stroke. But Kim Jong-il, I have photos of him going around with his father during the Korean War when he was 10 or 12 years old. And he began working in the party central committee in the early 1970s, really a quarter century before he took power. It's more a matter of his personality and his being uncomfortable in his own skin, literally in the sense that he once told a South Korean film director and his wife, an actress that some people think were kidnapped in North Korea, said that his body looked like, and I don't want to offend any of your viewers, but it looked like a little turd is what he said to this woman. And they later came out of North Korea and quoted all of this. But it's kind of evident in that he got the face he deserved by the time he was 40 or 45, a cynical face, a conspiratorial face. I think he felt there was very considerable opposition to him taking power within the country. Kim Jong-un has, so far at least, a much more a sunnier disposition and much more like his grandfather. Kim Il-sung, of course, was a dictator who often seemed to decide everything from the smallest to the largest issues in North Korea. But he was also one of the best politicians in the communist world. He was extremely good at interacting with the North Korean people effectively. Prince Sihanouk of Cambodia, had a villa in North Korea that Kim Il-sung provided to him, and they were very good friends. And I used to say it takes one king to know another. But Sihanouk said that Kim Il-sung had a relationship with his people like no other leader that he was aware of. And that's something coming from Sihanouk, who was a very beloved king in Cambodia, and of course is still alive.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Bruce Cummings. He's professor of history at the University of Chicago. He's authored several books about Korea. His most recent is Dominion from Sea to Sea, Pacific Ascendancy and American Power. It's now out in paperback from the Yale University Press. We're talking about North Korea. And questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. You can also send us an email if you'd like to do that. It's a will-talk, willtalk@illinois.edu. I want to come back to this and have you talk a little bit more about how Korean culture and Korean politics come together. And the thing that I'm thinking about here, there was an awful lot written about the reaction to Kim Jong-il's death and the great outpouring of emotion that we saw. And people asked this question, well, were people doing that because they were expected to, and in fact not to have done that would have been a sign of disloyalty, or was that a genuine expression of emotion? And I think that some people have actually gone as far as to say, well, actually the answer is yes to both.
Well, I think the answer is yes to both. In other words, there were people genuinely shocked and crying, felt terrible that he had died, and there were others who I'm sure were forcing their reactions. There is a competition in North Korea to show your loyalty to the great leader or the dear leader. I was astonished when I was there once, and a very commanding person, a tall Korean, that I was dealing with a British film crew. We were trying to negotiate for a documentary crew to get in there. And he had full confidence in himself, but whenever he would refer to Kim Il-sung, he would say, the great leader. He would lower his voice and say this, and that was apparently a new way to show your everlasting loyalty to this person. It's very abhorrent to anyone who is a Democrat or with a small d or a liberal, but we're talking about a country that had the most elaborate rituals for how the king was treated up until 1910, which is not so long ago. My wife is the dean at the University of Virginia, and I commute back and forth, and we live in a house that Thomas Jefferson designed on the campus. It's almost 200 years old, and it's one of the places in this country where history is taken very seriously, and everyone says Mr. Jefferson rather than Thomas, so on and so forth. Mm. In Korea, I think they take history quite more seriously than we do, and they have a history that goes back thousands of years. They have kings who came to power and ruled for 50 or 60 years at the age of 25 or 30, Sejong, who was their greatest king and who, in his reign, the Korean language was invented in the 15th century, was 30 when he took power. But the most interesting example is the last Korean king, Kojong, who came to power at the age of 11 in the 1860s. And his father was the regent, the Taewang-gun, as he was called. He became a very powerful figure in late 19th century politics. But then eventually Kojong came into his own and proved himself to be more of a reformer than the Taewang-gun, his father, who had really followed a hermit kingdom or seclusion policy. So there's enormous precedent for a young king to come to power and have a regent who guides him as he grows up. And in this case, you have Kim Jong-il's sister, Kim Kyung-hee, who was married to Chang Sung-taek, who was 65 years old. And Chang has held the most important security positions in the country for years, including commanding the security detail for Pyongyang. In other words, he's one of the most trusted handful of people around, and he's a blood relative of Kim Jong-il and the uncle of Kim Jong-un. So the idea, which many American commentators seem to have, that Kim Jong-un won't know what he's doing or he's too young, it assumes that this is a one-man leadership. It misses the historical resonance of monarchy in North Korea. And it also assumes that the people around him are boobs who don't know what they're doing, when in fact, if you look at the National Defense Commission, you have 12 members, many of them octogenarians, who've been around since the Korean War or even fought in it. So they will guide him. His problem will be to gain their, not their loyalty, which will be easy, but rather to be able to make decisions that they don't like. If I could say just one more thing about this. Kim Il-sung had maximum power up to the point where he died in 1994, but he told an interviewer a couple of years before he died that his hardest problem was with the older generation who were too conservative and opposed to change. Korea is a very patriarchal society, whether in North or South, and it's almost, if you're 40 years old and you try and tell an 80-year-old what to do, you almost have a nervous breakdown. It's that serious of a patriarchy. So he will be guided by these people. But ultimately, at some point, and I think it might be a few years hence, he will have to make decisions that nobody else can make because that's the way the system works. And the buck stops with the top leader. Other people are afraid to take responsibility. So I would expect a period of paralysis, even if not not much happening over the next 2 or 3 years. Furthermore, Kim Jong-il took a 3-year mourning period, which was the traditional period for the prince to mourn the king from 1994 to 97. And I'm interested to see that Kim Jong-un is actually out and around. But we'll see if he disappears for a while. It's quite possible he might decide to mourn his father as his father mourned his grandfather.
Mm-hmm. I think it's really quite fascinating to hear you talk about the relationship between the military, which seems to be the power in the country, and particularly this key figure, Mr. Chang, who is the uncle of Kim Jong-un, and how important he and I'm sure other people will be. And yet it's also so the figure of the great leader. And now, in this case, the mantle having passed to Kim Jong-un is also extremely important, and he has power in his own right or has the opportunity to exercise power. But it sounds as if also that whoever is in that position has both great symbolic significance and is in a position to exercise power, providing, of course, that they have the support of the military. So here we have both parties who have their own maybe individual and unique kind of opportunity to exercise power.
Well, the North Korean military is the fourth largest in the world. It has over 1 million men and women under arms. It has 6 or 7 million veterans who know how to fight. It's very well dug in. They have something like 15,000 underground facilities of a security nature. It is the most powerful force in the country. And Kim Jong-il relied on it from the time his father died. He enunciated a so-called Sun Gun policy, or which means putting the military first, which is quite remarkable in a communist system where the party is always supposed to rule the gun. So I think that indicated a level of insecurity on the part of Kim Jong-il, that he felt that he had to really make sure the military was satisfied, keep them satisfied, and keep them powerful. For a long time, the party seemed to be in eclipse, although it's making a little bit of a comeback lately. But I think the question, you know, when people talk about a collapse of North Korea or a coup or Kim Jong-un being, you know, wet behind the ears, the question is who is going to replace one of the Kims? Who is going to replace Kim Jong-un? This is a family upon which the entire legitimacy of the state of North Korea is based. And it may sound really odd to Americans to imagine this state having any legitimacy at all, but every state has to have legitimacy or it perishes. And the legitimacy of North Korea traces back to 1932, when Kim Il-sung and his friends began fighting the Japanese when they took over Manchuria, the northeast provinces of China, and established their third colony after Taiwan and Korea. These people fought a courageous and dreadful battle for 10 years against an enemy that gave no quarter, and tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of these guerrillas were killed. Kim Il-sung and about 200 others were lucky survivors. They came back and established their regime with Soviet help, but it was always a Korean regime run by Kim Il-sung's guerrilla group and two or three other guerrilla groups from Manchuria. And then in typical Korean fashion, they put their kids in the best schools, they intermarry, they establish an elite, much like the founding of the last dynasty, a 500-year dynasty in 1392, that was also established by a military man. So you have here a very strong system at the top with legitimacy deriving from a struggle against the Japanese. North Korea and Japan still have no diplomatic relations. They have no formal or normal relations. And, of course, hatred of the Japanese is very widespread in both Koreas. So this nationalist and patriotic background is very important to everybody who is part of the elite in North Korea. If someone came along from a different lineage, let alone a collaborationist lineage with the Japanese or the Americans, you know, they would have a great deal of trouble establishing power. So there are restive people in the North, lots of them, because about a fifth of the population is malnourished. They had a horrible famine 10 years ago. I'm sure there are people in the military and elsewhere who would like much more substantial reforms than have happened. But it really would be as if George Washington had become a king instead of a president. I don't want to be quoted calling Kim Il-sung the George Washington of Korea. Just saying, if George Washington were the president and had a son and a grandson and then a great-grandson who held power in a monarchy in this country and who traced their legitimacy back to the struggle against the British. So this is not a minor matter. It's the essence of the whole regime. And when you go there, even looking at their currency, some of the first battles in 1932 are commemorated on their equivalent of the dollar bill. So it's very important. And Kim Jong-un, therefore, inherits this legacy, regardless of whether, you know, he's smart or he's stupid or he's good-looking or he's not. Europe had centuries of monarchy. And there's a great book called The King's Two Bodies, a classic book that talked about the perfect king, and that's the one that rules France or Germany or wherever, Austria-Hungary, through the ages, and he can do no wrong. And then there's the corporeal human who happens to be king at a given time and maybe not much to look at or not much in the brain department, but he's the king. And so the monarchy goes on.
Mm-hmm. Our guest in this hour of Focus is Bruce Cummings. He's professor of history at the University of Chicago. We're talking about Korea. Questions welcome. In fact, we have a couple here ready to go. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. First in Belgium, line 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning. And I hope this isn't too far off the topic, or, but it seems to be germane to the whole topic at the same time. Is why is there still two Koreas? When you think about it, you talked about the history being so long of them having unified struggles against other problems, and they have family ties across the border. It seems to me the main reason they're not there isn't one Korea of two is because there's a bunch of people in them, in between them, mainly Americans. Why wouldn't they want them to move together?
Well, I think reunification has been the most important value of Koreans in North and South since 1945, and Americans do have a tremendous responsibility for that division because we drew the 38th parallel 24 hours after Nagasaki was obliterated in August of 1945 without consulting any Koreans or anybody else, including our allies. And it was supposed to be just a line to take the Japanese surrender. We would do it in the South, the Russians in the North. But everyone knew by then, and Stalin had said it already, that whoever occupies a territory imposes their own system on it. And that's essentially what happened within a few months of the division of Korea in 1945. However, I think the possibility of unification, however great in the 40s, became an impossible dream after the Korean War because it was one of the most vicious and destructive wars of the last century. Literally millions of Koreans died. Families were separated, much like in the American Civil War, where you sometimes had a brother fighting against a brother. And there are the figure usually used is some 10 million families that have relatives in the other half of Korea. They would love to see their relatives and be reunited. Family is such an important thing to Koreans and in Korean society. But a kind of division system, as a friend of mine, an intellectual in South Korea, has always called it, where those people who foster the division get rewards and those people who try to bridge the division go to jail. That's certainly true in North and South Korea today. It wasn't true for about 10 years from 1998 to 2008 when President Kim Dae-jung and his successor pursued a reconciliation policy with North Korea. That's really when I thought things were heading toward, if not reunification, then reconciliation. But a combination of things, including the Bush administration's extraordinarily hostile policy toward Kim Dae-jung's successor and, of course, toward North Korea, created a situation where North Korea finally went ahead and developed atomic bombs. I think they felt that they might get invaded like Iraq or Libya if they gave up their WMDs. I certainly know that that's what they think today. So it's going to be extremely hard to denuclearize North Korea, which would be a precedent or an essential precedent, according to President Obama, for us to go back to talk to them and for reconciliation to pick up again. I don't think myself that anything's going to happen for about a year because both South Korea and the U.S. are electing new presidents in the fall and winter of 2012. And in Korea, the current president can't run for another term, and he might be replaced by a progressive just won the mayoral position of Seoul in an election, which is a very important sign of things to come, I think. So I don't think you'll see much happening. North Korea wants to consolidate leadership under Kim Jong-un. They're going to wait to see who the new American and Korean leaders are. And, of course, China is also having a succession as Hu Jintao steps down. Russia is having an election, and Putin has been a very good friend to Kim Jong-il. So it's a year of flux, and if I were sitting in North Korea, I would want to sit and wait. But the questioner is, I think, very right to point the finger at foreigners, both the U.S. and the Soviet Union, Japan, Russia. I said that already, but Russia is not the Soviet Union. and China. None of them want reunification of the Korean Peninsula for different reasons, but there isn't any great power pressure to reunify. It's more a matter of most of them thinking North Korea is going to collapse sooner or later, and that's how the country will be unified. I think that that particular hypothesis has been shown to be wrong for the last 22 years, but you never know.
We're talking this hour of Focus about Korea. Our guest is Bruce Cummings. He's professor of history at University of Chicago. I have another call we'll get to in just a moment. First, we need to take a short break. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, the story of Rin Tin Tin, a dog found in the wreckage of a kennel during World War I, who would become one of film, radio, and television's biggest stars. We'll talk with author Susan Orlean about her new book, Rin Tin Tin, The Life and the Legend. It's her first original book since her bestseller, The Orchid Thief. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Programs on WILL are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting audiences to enjoy Krannert Uncorked, a weekly free wine tasting almost every Thursday at 5 p.m. in the lobby. More information is available at krannertcenter.com.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings 10 to noon, 10 different topics every week. Tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, we will talk about the effort to provide increased broadband access for Internet to citizens of Champaign-Urbana, this project that's being called UC2B. We'll talk with a number of guests here about what the project is, the intention, where things stand, what's going on right now. Also, we will talk tomorrow about the history of the effort against drunk driving. The guest there will be Baron Lerner. He's a professor of medicine and public health at Columbia University and is author of a book on the subject. The title of his book is One for the Road, Drunk Driving Since 1900. We're here weekday mornings, 10 to noon. You can check the schedule by going to the website, and that is WILL.illinois.edu. In this hour of Focus, we're talking with Bruce Cummings. He's professor of history at University of Chicago, where he's also chair of the Department of History. His interest is in modern Korean history, also U.S. East Asian relations. He's authored a number of books, and his most recent is titled Dominion from Sea to Sea, Pacific Ascendancy and American Power. It's published by the Yale University Press, now out in paperback. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller. Champaign County, number one. Hello.
Hi, good morning.
Yes.
I wish the ascendancy was Pacific and not just in the Pacific. I wanted to draw you out on your thoughts on the new military stance vis-a-vis the whole Korean East Asian area. And I've always thought that one of the first things a U.S. President could do is suspend the spring military maneuvers, and I think I've heard you on that issue as well. So, but it doesn't seem like anything is going that way. It seems like the Great Game is surrounding China, and I just wanted to draw you out on that. I'll just also recommend your it's an older piece, but your forward to the Hidden History of the Korean War by F. Stone was a very seminal reading for me, and appreciate your longstanding efforts on the issue.
Well, thank you so much. I.F. Stone was a hero of mine. He wasn't an historian, but an investigative journalist, and I once had the privilege of having dinner with him when he was about 85 years old and learning Greek and Latin, which is, I guess, something that all of us should think about, trying to improve ourselves as long as we live. I think one of the problems in our relations with North Korea is a lack of investigative journalism, so that you get the same views over and over again. Kim Jong-il uses silver chopsticks. He swills cognac, you know, so on and so forth. And since I read a lot of this stuff, it's just very repetitive. But to get to the gentleman's question, President Obama has made a major change in American military policy. He has ended the Iraq War, pulled troops out, which surprised me because it's the only war, except for Vietnam, where we haven't left bases after the war either is ended or a stalemate develops, as in Korea. He has established a new American base on the North Australian coast. even though we have bases all over the region, especially in Okinawa, which is within an easy reach of China, the 7th Fleet and the 6th Fleet in 7th Fleet in the Pacific, 6th in the Indian Ocean, are enormously more powerful than anything the Chinese have. But he's reinforcing that. And what the effect is in Korea is that any thought of withdrawing American troops or drawing them down has been completely forgotten. And many South Koreans are worried that they might be drawn into a war with China, in that Donald Rumsfeld, when he was defense secretary, established a policy of saying that we will use those troops any place we want, the ones in Korea, and he took 9,000 of them out to fight in the Iraq war. But if there's a war over Taiwan, South Korea worries that China might target American bases and maybe South Korean assets, in spite of the fact that South Korea wouldn't be involved in it. The U.S. is engaged in a containment policy of China, and this in spite of our just vastly superior military strength. I've watched a couple of people come on CNN and talk about how the Chinese are spending so much money on defense and they're about to catch up with us and all of that. It's just complete tommy rot. They have an old Soviet aircraft carrier that they've been fooling around with for a few years. Can't compare to ours. We would blow it out of the water in 5 seconds if it shot at us. Their ICBM fleet is 60s and 70s vintage. Their missiles that are up to date are mostly directed at Taiwan to intimidate Taiwan and in case there's a war there. So, but I have to say, I see no difference between an Obama foreign policy and a McCain foreign policy had John McCain won the presidency in 2008. It's just a redirection, a major redirection of American efforts toward the Pacific and toward competing with China, but also containing it.
We're moving into maybe have about 10, 12 minutes left in this part of the show. Questions welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. To go back just a little bit to relations between North and South, there had been, this is, I guess, going back some years, had been an agreement or some agreements entered into that would have facilitated investments in the North by the South. But when the current South Korean leader took office, Lee Myung-bak, he said, well, before that could happen, the North is going to have to give up its nuclear weapons, so a nuclear program. So that sort of brought an end to that. He, interestingly enough, in his New Year's address said something like, I think that there are going to be big changes ahead for the Korean Peninsula. Didn't exactly say what that meant. And you've talked about the fact that now, you know, who knows what's going to happen. There's going to be change of government here, like could be change of administration here, change of administration, and there will be in South Korea because he can't run again. So do you have some sense, though, of how what things will be happening, or will anything much be happening, anything new, moving forward over the next few years involving the two governments, the governments of the North and the government of the South?
Well, we should really remember that the second summit between the North and South Korean leaders, the first being in June 2000, the first time the two presidents ever met, Kim Dae-jung and Kim Jong-il at that time, that was followed in October 2007 by a second summit between President Noh Moo-hyun of South Korea and Kim Jong-il. And they made a number of agreements that vastly expanded what had been going on in Kaesong, a very old capital of Korea that used to, well, it was bisected by the 38th parallel, but it's been in North Korea since the war. There's a huge export zone there with foreign firms, mostly South Korean, employing about 45,000 North Korean workers for export-led production. And the plan was to go up to as many as 800,000 workers. So this is a huge deal. It's the first export zone in the North that really has been functioning well. And in 2007, the two leaders at the summit made an agreement to extend that westward to the port of Jeju and then around the southwest corner of North Korea to the port of Pyongyang. And that would have really, had it been done, created a very important political economy dynamic that would link the most productive part of South Korea, which is the Seoul Incheon area, with the richest area of North Korea, with these port cities. Well, I mean, these solemn agreements were made, and Lee Myung-bak came into power and acted as if nobody had ever made them, and said he was going to get tough with North Korea, take a hard line, not coddle them the way he said his predecessors had. And the result has been not just zero, but increasing tension, including fighting in March of 2010 and November and December of 2010, in which a South Korean ship was sunk by the North with a significant loss of life, artillery exchanges, things like that. But throughout this whole period of the Lee presidency, other things have been closed down, joint ventures and tourism and things like that. But the Kaesong zone has remained open. And that, I think, is the most important indicator we have that North Korea wants to continue moving in this direction. They're just not going to do it with a president whose real goal is the collapse or, well, what we used to call regime change in Iraq. That has been the real goal of the Lee administration. And the North Koreans know it. The Obama administration knows it. And yet the Obama administration has backed up President Lee to the hilt. And the result has been North Korea has blown off two atomic bombs, launched a long-range missile, and are, I'm sure, busily making more atomic bombs. So I can't really say there's been much success in North-South relations since that second summit in 2007.
I think it's fair to say, as far as the rest of the world is concerned, the big concern in regards to North Korea is its nuclear ambitions, and I think that you can't downplay the potency of a nuclear weapon as a symbol of national sovereignty and national power. Maybe even something that even goes beyond its utility in war. At the same time, we hear these stories about how threatened the North Koreans feel by the outside world, the United States particularly. When it comes to the nuclear weapons, though, which of those things actually do you think is the more important motivator?
Well, I think, first of all, that the only real achievement Kim Jong-il could have pointed to in 17 years in power is the achievement of a nuclear deterrent. Otherwise, his people were starving. The economy barely grew. In fact, it nearly collapsed in the late 1990s. The industrial economy did collapse, and it was hard to feed the people. Things have improved in recent years, but it's not like they're charging ahead. Their growth rates are, 2%, maybe less than that, or no growth at all. So the nuclear deterrent is about the only thing you can point to. Otherwise, you have 17 years of failure. Secondly, the U.S. has targeted North Korea with nuclear weapons since the Korean War. It had, in fact, installed hundreds of nuclear weapons in South Korea under American control from 1958 to 1991. George H.W. Bush took them out, but everybody knows a Trident submarine can glide up somewhere near North Korea and essentially demolish the country in one fell swoop. So North Korea has no illusions that its atomic weapon can be used except in the greatest extremity, which is if they think they're going down. And that's what makes the situation so difficult, because it was established American policy throughout most of the 90s that North Korea was going to collapse. It is the policy of South Korea that if it isn't going to collapse, we ought to help it make it collapse. And I've always argued since the Berlin Wall fell that if you understand North Korea, this is a regime that will go down fighting. And that's, of course, the reason it has such a huge military. So the nuclear weapon has a very important psychological function for North Korean security. And given that Saddam Hussein and Muammar Gaddafi both gave up their WMDs and then ended up being shot in a gopher hole or being tortured to death in the case of Gaddafi, it's going to be extremely hard outside of ironclad security guarantees that the U.S., China, and the Soviet Union would provide. Very, very hard to get them to give up their nuclear weapons. But among the so-called rogue states, this is the only one that ever froze its primary plutonium facility, its only facility for generating plutonium, from 1994 to 2002 in a so-called October framework agreement with the U.S. That's very important evidence that at least at one point they were willing to freeze, and the agreement called also for dismantling that Yongbyon plutonium facility after the U.S. had provided light water reactors for North Korea's energy regime. So it's going to be very hard to walk them back to that point, but Kim Il-sung, before he died, said that the Korean Peninsula should be denuclearized. And it might be. There are people like Joel Witt who have argued this, a very good North Korea watcher, who have said in a general an ironclad agreement on denuclearization, we probably can get rid of North Korea's nuclear weapons and missiles.
About 5 minutes left here in the Sparta Focus. Again, our guest is Bruce Cummings. He's professor of history, University of Chicago. We're talking about Korea. Someone wants to get in real quick, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. You mentioned in passing these events that took place back in 2010, when in March a South Korean naval ship was attacked and sunk. I think everyone thinks that it's certainly the North did this. And then in November, there was an island, Yeonpyeong Island, was shelled by the North. And what I have read recently and at the time, I think that a lot of people, at least people who weren't specialists in Korean history, were kind of scratching their heads and saying, well, what was that about? I think most recently I've read some things that suggest what that was about was establishing some kind of military credentials for Kim Jong-un. Do you think that is the explanation for those events?
No, I don't think that at all. The South Korean intelligence folks, all during the period when Kim Jong-il was clearly the successor, they would blame him for every attack or incident or terrorist incident or whatever. They would say he was behind it. Believe me, Kim Jong-un back in March 2010 was not capable of by himself ordering this attack on the Chonan, this South Korean ship. That area of Korea is one that should give anybody who knows it well nightmares, because there have been numerous clashes going back over a decade in that West Sea area, because no one knows. It's a kind of no man's land. The demilitarized zone was very carefully worked out between the U.S. and the North Koreans and Chinese at the end of the war, and nobody really challenges it. But the U.S. occupied three islands within 7 miles of the North Korean shore and were sending agents into North Korea during the war. And they continued in occupation of those islands after the war ended. So one of our generals established the so-called Northern Limit Line, which goes north of those islands and cuts right through the territorial waters of North Korea. So you have the anomaly of three islands controlled by the South that are in the 12-mile limit territorial waters of North Korea. Every country is recognized to have a 12-mile limit. So when South Korea shells, as it did, into those waters, North Korea says those are our waters. And in the case of, I think the Chonan was done by the North Koreans, even though some of my colleagues disagree, and the Russians did too in a report they did on it. But I think it was payback for a November of 2009 attack in which a North Korean ship went down. No one asked who did it. Quite a few people died. But as I was going to say, I didn't quite get to it, that in June 1999, one of the first of these incidents happened in the same place, where a North Korean ship was sunk and 25 or 30 of them died. And I thought, my God, they're not going to take this lying down. Something's going to happen. And then I realized nothing happened because they were already working on the summit between the two leaders that occurred a year later. So there's been violence in this area, fights over fishing and crabbing grounds. But fundamentally, the Northern Limit Line is illegal. And that's not my opinion. That's what Henry Kissinger said when he was Secretary of State. It has no international standing. And yet the North Koreans have honored it for the most part, going back to 1953. So this is the area where a conflict could develop say, you know, one side sinks another ship, and then they escalate, and it ratchets up, and suddenly you have a new Korean War coming out of this mess that that has existed for 60-odd years in the West Sea.
Hmm. Well, we're here at the point where we just about have to finish. Just very quickly, unfortunately, it would have to be less than a minute. Is there some possibility of things moving forward here in a positive way?
I was just looking this morning at a bunch of photos that a friend of mine sent me, color photos that he took last August in North Korea, of one market after another and people sitting by the side of the road selling stuff in front of their homes. North Korea has changed a great deal. One of these pictures showed a woman who had had a so-called westernized eyelid plastic surgery, which is extremely common in South Korea. Many, many women have it, but he noted that this is going on in North Korea, and the women were dressed very nicely with makeup, hairdos very much like a South Korean woman might wear. So you have a younger generation that is really middle class and is rather numerous. And I think you're going to see something happen from that middle class, perhaps not like in Eastern Europe in 1989, where young people really took the lead in essentially disestablishing peacefully most of the communist regimes in East Europe. But I do think Kim Jong-un, having studied in Switzerland, experienced a free society for a few years. Once he gets his feet on the ground, I'm hoping that he'll expand those markets and begin to do what China did after 1979 in opening up to the world market.
All right. Bruce Cummings is our guest. He's professor of history at University of Chicago. Professor Cummings, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.